Welcome to the Friends of McGill Hockey Podcast. This is Ken Tyler, your host for the Captain's Meeting. We have the good fortune today to welcome Patrick Delisle-Houde back into the fold of the McGill Redbirds. After four intensive years with Les Habitants de Montréal, Patrick is moving from the fitness room to the bench as he takes on the full-time challenge of being an associate coach with our program. You'll hear a lot of different sides in Patrick, from his academic sports sciences to his very personable coaching approach that he has already used in the last 4 years and will take with him as he moves into the coaching responsibilities with McGill. He's a very devout family man, an intense hockey professional, and a recognized academic. Most importantly for our hockey program, he's got a very strong sense in what he wants for his young men in the hockey program and beyond. But let's dive in and hear direct from the coach himself. Welcome, Patrick. You've been connected with McGill for an awful long time. Can you just tell us what your journey's been from the start right through to coming back this year?
Well, I got recruited in the end of 2012 when the team was going to the national championship by Dan Jacob. Actually, he came pick me up in a van in Gatineau, and we got lost on the way back, which was great memories. We're still talking about it. I'd made my visiting trip here at McGill, spent the night at 456 with the boys that were living there back
As
then.
As a recruit, you stayed at 456?
Yeah, I stayed on the couch that night, and like a year later, not even a year later, 4 months later, I was living there with Patrick Belzile and JP Mathieu, which was great. After that, I did my undergrad in kinesiology during my first 3 years. We had the chance to go to national championship once during those 3 years in Saskatoon.
Yeah.
It was in 2014.
14, yeah, okay.
Yeah, lost against Alberta in the second game, 2-1. It was second overtime. Jacob Jarochinov was the goalie back then. I think he had like 68 save.
Yeah, he was a great goaler at that time.
Oh, that's good memory. After that, I completed my graduate degree, my master in exercise physiology for my year 4 and 5 at McGill, where I started to be captain at Christmas.
Why at Christmas?
I think Eric and Kelly kind of taught me a lesson that you need to be an example. And sometimes I was the kind of the type that was taking a lot of like penalties. If like older player look at the numbers, it was not that much for them. If younger player look at the numbers, yes, it was a little bit of like sometime undisciplined penalties. I didn't like when guys were pushing us around, and I was able to get back in the mix and push a little bit too much, and they didn't want me to do that. So they kind of taught me a lesson, which was good. Good humility lesson.
So when you say they, who do you mean?
Eric and Kelly.
Okay, so Kelly was the head and Eric was the assistant at that time.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Well, isn't that, that must have taken quite a few conversations actually. In particular, because I know how much you value and respect the relationship that you've had with both, and now you're back working with Ork, so something worked well out of that situation. What was it?
Ork and Kelly always been like, when they were coaching me, they've always been like very respectful and straight to the point. As you guys probably noticed in the past, I'm a man of few words, so I'm the same thing. I go straight to the points and I don't discuss things too much. But I don't go left or right. I go straight there. And it was fair and honest. I think it made me grow over time. It helped me out to gaining a bigger understanding of my leadership perspective.
And your contribution to the team and the role you were meant to play.
Yeah, exactly. I think I had a better understanding of what it represented. And it helped me out in the long run.
So they were saying you're overdoing your aggressiveness in a sense. You're getting too involved and push back. Or what are they saying with that?
Yeah, that was exactly it. Exactly, a little bit more like stay between the whistle, which is something that we try to teach our players right now.
Yeah,
We're staying between the whistle and nothing after it. And I think it helped me out being able to play 5 years.
Yeah,
and helped me out to be staying on the ice for like in the important situation.
And who was the captain with you that year?
We started the season with four alternate captains.
Okay,
with myself, Liam Ellis, Etienne Boutet, and Vincent Bernard, which is fun. I'm still in contact with the three of the guys, not on a weekly basis, but very often.
Really, that frequently?
Well, Barney just texted me this morning, actually.
Oh, did he?
telling me that our hockey pool is not going well.
We got to work on that. Better make a
we're
push on this.
Yeah.
Oh, you're okay. You guys are teammates in a hockey pool. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And Liam, you're in touch with because you can also get him continue some of his good recruiting, huh?
Yeah, but most mostly just because he's a great friend of mine. We live together. We hang out together all the time. So I ask him questions about like the guys, but that's not our main conversation, I would say.
Yeah, that's a nice way to have it too. Okay, so you graduated with a master's in exercise physiology. And you'd played 5 years at McGill. Then what did you do?
In my last year, I started working 2 to 4 days with the Montreal Canadiens. And it was funny because I kind of knew that the following year, they would be opening up like a sports science department.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like what I was doing. I was helping out there, increasing the number of people that they needed. The following year, when they opened the job, they reached out to me and they asked me if I was interested. So I started working for them as the strength and conditioning coordinator for 4 years. And that's where that leadership, like, lesson kind of helped me out a little bit more, because when you're showing up in front of like first guy that are way older than you, I was 26 back then, and like Shea Weber might have been like 33, and I still have to let him know what to do in the gym and what to do sometime on the ice as well when if he was injured or if I was like driving the training camp before the season. You know, the players are arriving maybe 2 weeks before training camp. Well, the role of the strength and conditioning coach is to make sure they're well trained on the ice and off the ice as well before training camp starts.
So you had to develop individual files for each athlete. You had to know what kind of program they were following. You had to do an assessment, and then you had to map out the year, not regarding injury, because unless they came in with injury, you had to map out the year and then adapt that based on performance, travel, and then injury.
Exactly. Performance, travel, momentum swing, emotional swing as well, because like, you're dealing with human, you're not really dealing with machines. So some morning they're going to show up and like you had a good, great plan in mind, but that plan won't be what you need to do that day.
Yeah. So you need to adapt. It can't just be a black and white program that you say, got to do it. Need your reps, got to do the check off at the end of the day. Otherwise not working. You've got to adapt psychologically to where the athlete is at.
Yeah, exactly. And if you walk into the McGill's room right now, one of the first keyword you're going to see on the wall is be adaptable.
That's right. I was in there in the summertime with work and did a tour and did some analysis in terms of what the needs were.
So that's where he talked to me about it.
Did he?
Yeah. It's something. It's a continuous chat. Yeah, always to get better, how to adapt to like the new players that are coming in. You want them to be their room as well, not just like somebody that come from the older player. Like it's everybody together.
So you were still a McGill student, graduate student, master's. And how did they connect with you to bring you in? And what role did you play on that particular sports strength and conditioning coaching team?
I knew their the head strength coach back then, Pierre Allard. And I started 2 years before that, helping out for fitness testing. Okay. Twice, three times a year. And become a little bit more and become a little bit more and always increase it over like time. And my last year was like 2 to 4 days. And I was taking care of the catapult system mostly, which was the catapult system, which was the monitoring system on the ice. So we had to cut every drill to make sure to know what was the load imposed on the player during those practice.
So that's the feedback you're giving not to the players, but rather to the coaching staff so they know how to fashion their practicing.
That was to both, I would say.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you give, like, a general report to the coaches, but any players that were interested in knowing what they've been doing in the last week or what they've been doing the last month were coming into the office. It was a pleasure for us to explain them where they were going, what they had to change, maybe habits. Also, sometimes it's just to know, did I experience the drill properly? Did I push myself enough? Am I doing enough sprints during a practice, or am I like coasting the entire practice?
Is this the player talking and or the coach talking?
Players talking. The coaches were more like about the team. So are my drills representing what I want to represent? If I'm doing a 2-on-1 and I want it to be game-like situation, well, the speed that they attain, that they reach on the ice should be the same as during a game. If I want a coasting drill and being like more of a down drill between two very intense, but the workload is super high, well, maybe I'm not achieving the goal I'm looking for. So it's a little bit more of like you have your plan and you're verifying your plan with the data afterwards. So it's not a data-driven decision. It's a data-informed decision. You know what's happening after.
But you're saying after. Now, that has you very close to the planning of the coach in each practice if they're going to pay heed to the type of data that you're able to deliver.
Yes, I was gathering those data at the beginning when I was an intern, but that was a lot. That was more of a sports science director that was doing this. I was not going to see the coach when I was an intern, that's for sure.
Yeah. But the coach was paying heed to that information as he prepared the practices, or did he only take that as information after the practices?
Mostly after practices. And it depends also, like sometimes he was more interested in others, sometimes he was less interested. I'm sure you know that like our base on like winning, losing, emotion.
Yeah, exactly. The coaching staff is not necessarily hired still for their interactivity with sports sciences as of yet. That's still fairly new. The learning path of a professional coach at that level is also not necessarily guaranteeing them an awful lot of insights into or education in sports sciences.
Part of the job was to educate everybody on this. Yeah, like a job from a physiotherapist is to educate everybody on like on health and like how to take care of themselves during a season. Well, part of our job was to educate players and coaches on how that could help them in the short run and also in the long run in their career.
Yeah. And so part of the issue that you would have and that you have going forward is that you have effectively more knowledge than will be applicable in the situation you're in, because it's only one of the factors, right? You can have a major impact with it, but you've got to be careful you don't overload or overdo.
It's funny because coaching is, I'm sure, like you'd be probably the best person to say yes or no, but coaching is a art and science. You need to mix the art, but also have like a little bit of science behind it. And it's just another tool in the box that you can use. It's not the tool that you have.
Very delicate, because you're not coming in with a high as a sports scientist, okay? And as an associate coach with a sports science background that you have, you still need to be very delicate and tactful in terms of how you put this across to the coaching staff, because they don't necessarily see it that way, given a difficult situation with their team or any one particular athlete.
Good situation, you always need to be like careful in what you say, how you say it, and that comes with experience. And we're lucky at McGill, we're like, it's in our plan to build like a sports science relationship with the kinesiology department.
Yeah.
And Eric's been working with those data as well in the past. Like he's very informed and very knowledgeable about it, which can help us just bring it slowly to a pace that's like the players and us can utilize to its maximum. We don't need to bring it fully and not use anything. You need to bring just slow pieces that you can use at a time that players and coaches are able to absorb and use and not being like disruptful for the rest.
Without it being the major component of your coaching approach, because as you say, it's the artistry or the ability to be an artist or somebody who can interpret what needs to be done as a coach to enhance performance over the long run and the short run, both, that science doesn't quite have all the answers for, because it's an empirical approach. And it typically, you take exercise physiology, you take biomechanics, you take psychology, so you take sociology, social psychology, and whatever other ones you've got, they don't even put together, they don't give you a good coach. Often your best coach is a person who walks in off the street, who's been working with people in dynamic situations for an awful long time, but doesn't understand science whatsoever.
No, exactly. It's just a tool in the basket.
So that you move right into me then asking you to why you decide to leave the Les Canadiens for McGill, and what's the orientation you will be taking as a coach now, as an associate coach now, given the background that you've got. So let's start with that one first. What's the approach you're taking as an associate coach? You're doing your doctorate in exercise physiology, and you're coming in as an associate coach, which means you're extremely close to the head coach and have a huge part of that platform. And you're coming in, however, as a sports scientist and as an exercise physiologist, that being the major part of your career, as opposed to coaching skills, if I can say that correctly. So throw it back at me, get the elbows up and tell me, tell me what you're thinking.
Like, let's say over the last 4 years, I've been like the good part of strength and conditioning, you're in the gym, you're on the ice, you're dealing with the players on a daily basis. You kind of realize what you like, what you don't like, what's your major focus, what you enjoy the most, what you think you're the best at. After like those 4 years, I kind of realized it. Well, I would say it's probably, I've been 2 years. After two years, I've kind of realized that what I was preferring was helping the players to develop themselves on the ice. Also as a person, as a leader, which is perfect, because coming back to McGill, coming back to my second home as an assistant coach, as associate coach with McGill. The major focus is to develop hockey player, good students, and leaders in the future world. And that, those are my, like, those are our key plan as a coaching team with ERG. And that's why I came back as well, because that's what I was looking for, working with that kind of population to make sure they're being developed on the ice in their, in, at school and in the upcoming world that is coming at them very quickly.
Absolutely. That's a great set of criteria by which you measure your impact on your student athlete.
That's what I'm looking for as a coach, having an impact in those three spheres.
Okay. And how do you know that you're achieving that?
The first thing is to making sure that, like, I have a communication with the players. We're deciding on, like, objective on the ice, objective in the classroom, and the leadership part, which is probably the most abstract part because it's a little bit harder to measure. We have leadership plans, so we're going to make sure we develop leaders over time, either with example, with meetings with them, with leadership groups, with accountability meeting, making sure we're, like, regrouping all of this and we're putting them into a situation that they can succeed as future leader in our upcoming world.
And that's a leadership plan you actually have for the dossier of each player? You have a leadership development plan?
I wouldn't say that. I would be a total liar if I would say they all build right now.
Okay.
But it's something, it is something in progress. I'm not a liar. So no, we don't have a leadership plan for everybody. We have a leadership plan right now for, like, the team, how it's going to work out, like, over time during the season. And pieces are always in movement as well, because we realize that we need to change stuff and we need to adapt over time as well.
Well, first of all, I love the idea of a leadership plan as a part of their dossier. I think that's an outstanding, and going back and listening to all the stories of the last few generations of coaches, they've picked that up step by step. And I, you know, me passing on and actually not getting in the fellow that would have been doing that for us, he didn't get the job at first, but then luckily Marty and Jamie got in and got it rolling. And well, and then Jamie moved on in his career, but Marty stayed and had an illustrious career over the last, whatever it was, 17 years, whatever it was, and started instituting some of this, you might call leadership planning for the person, with a lot of the readings that he's recommending and the kind of approach that he took. And then Kelly had the same kind of thing going on with respect to an orientation towards a leadership group, and leading being a key part of the program, including the mentoring and whatnot. Who puts all that together? Does that come under your auspices? And what plans do you have to take that, to get that onboarded again and to take that further?
It's a head coach kind of thing, because he's the leader on top. I'm more of a support role in this, but Herc is great in the sense that, like, every decision that he makes, we're discussing about it. So this leadership plan is an ongoing discussion on how we can further himself into a leader position among the team. And we're not just talking about our leaders group. We're talking about all of our players, because I'm sure he discussed with you guys that, like, some guys are going to be pulling, some guys are going to be pushing from the bottom, some guys are going to be pushing from the side, and everybody needs to push in the same direction at the end of the day. And this is part of our leader's plan, that, like, we're going to develop different type of leaders over time. They're going to probably change after years, which is good. This is actually a good point. Maybe we should have, like, a different folder for everybody over time. I did take a note, as you can see.
Okay. So I definitely did. I had an idea for that when I was coaching back then. But of course, you people are certainly much further along in the science of coaching than what we were back then, when it was all just starting out. But I've made a point of ensuring that the captain had a 1-year term, even if he feasibly would be coming back for a fifth year. If he came back for a fifth year, part of his mandate was to pass on the captaincy in coordination with the coaching staff to make that decision, and then to have an outgoing speech and have an incoming speech for that captain. And I really do think that that created a lot of magic in the leadership systems that we had, because they were, a lot of them came back and became non-captains, like, for example, in my era, a Bobby Orr, who was never captain. Okay, didn't need to be. It was amazing to see the commitment that they had with and for each other during their years of leadership, official leadership in the organization, because of that. and the lack of dependency of any one particular person to be representing them, but rather, as you're saying, it's a group thing and it's a group of leaders that need to do it. I love hearing the stuff that you coaches and your generations have been doing, and now you have the chance as a coach to contribute to that. And I think it's a brilliant piece of the organization and the coaching approach. You now have 28 to 30 top-notch athletes. How do you focus on the top eight? How do you get that going? Because when you want, if you look at that a national championship team, you can identify the people who had stellar years and showed that they had stellar years with the statistics that you can clearly see. If you don't have those players playing at their very best and breaking through their levels, how do you do that when you have 28 top-notch players and they're all pretty much junior major players? How can you focus on the top eight when you've only got an X number of coaches and X amount of time and only one team that plays? Because that means you've got at least eight to 10 players not playing every game.
So focusing on the top eight, do we focus on the top eight? It's a very good question. I would say that like in two ways. The first ways would probably be those top eight needs to be leaders. And the second way is like we talk about like raising the bar, pushing the ceiling up. But you just know for your top eight, you got to push the ceiling up, but they got to raise the floor. So if they do raise the floor, the team's being raised at the same time because we're setting standard that we need to achieve. That's how we're focusing on our top eight, I would say.
But you still have a lot of players who don't get to play much and they're really good players. How do you deal with that part?
So we modify a little bit things this year. This year we have like morning skate. So we have ice almost every day except one day a week. So everybody gets like a day off, which is good for players to just like reset their minds Sunday, prepare your meals for the week, get ready for the week. The rest of the days we're making sure that they're ready physically by having them on the ice days that they're not playing. And we're making sure they have like a workout with our strength and conditioning coach, Laura, at the same time, because we want them to stay sharp. So it's very important for us to get a touches on every single of our players almost every day. So they're still included and they're still feeling part of the team because they might need to jump on at any time. A good example this week, we have 9 Ds. Mm-hmm. We only had 6 available for the game.
Because?
Injury.
Injury, okay. Already in training camp.
It's intense.
So there's the advantage. What I'm hearing you say is intensity allows you to bring the level of practice up to a more realistic or beyond game level of intensity because you have the numbers.
We do have the numbers. It helps us a lot. And when everybody's healthy and everybody's on the ice, it allows us to get like a great pace. And a little bit, I'm sure you read the legacy book from the All Blacks. And they talk about it that like they want to raise the pace and the intensity of their practice higher than the game. So when the clean games come, this is an easy game for them. That's a little bit the same role as we have. We got to bring the intensity and the hardness into practice that when the game show up on Friday night, it's a standard game. It's not like anything special for them. It's just, okay, mm-hmm. We're back to work tonight.
So here's an old coach telling you the All Blacks were the All Blacks, but there was a hockey example prior to that. And it's the book written by Anatoly Tarasov. Don't know if you know who he yeah. was. Yeah. Okay, good. He did that. That from us, from the hockey generation, my generation coming right after him, he was our mentor with respect to that. The pace at which he would do his practices, the goal was to have it faster and harder and more intense than what he would have his athletes facing in a game. Yeah. So it comes back from him in the 50s. So it's before the All Blacks. We as hockey players will reclaim that. So why did you want to become a coach? Why not a professor? Why not in exercise physiology department in hospitals or your own clinic?
The first thing I would say, the love for the sport. I like, we're all hockey guy. We love like talking about the sport. How can we get better every day? How can we get like our team better? Also, just because, like I said a little earlier, I wanted to develop hockey player on the ice, students, and leaders. And the university level is a great level for that because guys are at the top of their mind right now. They're just coming up to university. They're getting grown. They're growing up into a person. They're getting ready for the future, either as a hockey player or as a future professional. And I felt that like this position was great to help them grow.
I have to agree with you. I've coached at various levels, not North American pro, which you have, but certainly across the world in international competition. And my favorite times of coaching were the times in university, because you had such an opportunity to have significant impact on the lives of the athletes. And they were in a position in their lives and with a level of intellect, which allowed them to, with their curiosity in particular, to be sponges. It was the university time. The 18 to 24 year old athlete, university level athlete, was so brilliant to be able to have an opportunity to work with because of that, and because of the impact you feasibly could have for them, which brings us right back to another key question I have for you. And that is, what are your personal core values as a coach? And how did they get formed?
Well, they got formed by my playing experience, by my coaching experience at with the Canadians. My first one would be, I call it McGill Will. It's relentless. You need to be relentless in everything you do. The second one would be, you need to be respectful. Respectful of what you do, because you were lucky of being able to do what we do every day. Respectful of your environment, what others do, and respectful of the others. And the last one would be joy, because you need to have fun. It's like, it's an opportunity. We have a little time here and we need to enjoy that time every day. It's appreciating the little things. Like, you're getting up in the morning, I'm getting up in the morning, I'm beside my wife and my daughters. That's a little thing that I enjoy every day. Going to the rink, we're getting ready for a practice. Is how many people are able to practice every day? I'm sure lots of old timer would love to play hockey every day. We are right now. Let's enjoy it. The competition in it. How can we compete every day and loving it? That's something that like I have in me. And when I'm on the ice, the guys, and I'm teaching something, well, I'm teaching them and I'm loving it because I know they're going to compete with it at the end.
Excellent. Who were your key mentors? You mentioned the Canadians, but you've also had history in junior and in minor and in university. Who were your key mentors and what were your critical experiences that had you sort of determined to move into coaching as you grew?
Well, a key mentor for me would be Serge Beausoleil. He coached me major AAA. Then he moved on to be coaching Rimouski right now with the Oceanic. He was the head coach back then. He was also my history professor in high school. He's been like a big part of it. I would also say Pierre Allard, which was my boss with the Montreal Canadiens, the sports science director. Mm. Always been good with me. He had a bunch of different experience as a coach, as a strength coach, as an entrepreneur. And I would say Kelly. And the reason is like, Kelly's been the coach that like coached me the most for 5 years.
For 5 years, yeah.
Kelly, you learned to love him and to hate him at the same time, which was a great part of it, because you know he's always on you on a certain points, and he's like very direct with you and he's not gonna hide anything. And I developed a great, like, great respect for Kelly, and I had a great relationship with him.
That's a great description of a great coach. You may not always love him, you may not always hate him, but you always respect him. What do you find the most difficult part of being a coach?
The most difficult part of being a coach sometimes is, and it's probably something that like, as a player you have to experience as well, and as any other part, you only control what you can control. Sometimes you would like to control everything, but you can only control what you can control. And that is limited when you think about it. It's very limited. That would be the hardest part, I would say.
Okay, is learning to contribute within your realm of what you can influence and understand what you cannot.
And it's also, it becomes with time of how you can like impact. Just I feel with over time, it's going to help me out with like controlling a little bit more, or maybe tweaking a little bit more what I can influence and what I cannot influence over time.
How do you sort of foresee this? You're doing a doctorate, which will take you 3 years, maybe 3 to 5. I'm not sure which. How does that get integrated with what you're doing in academia? And how do you foresee that going forward once you finish your doctorate? Start with how that gets integrated with the full-time study workload of a doctorate program.
You need to be able to manage your time. You need to be prioritizing what you like and what you prefer, what you want to do. So I identified 3 parts in my life right now. I identified my family first, and that would stay like this forever. Second would be right now is my associate coaching job. And third one would be my doctorate. So that's how I allow the time to each one of them. After that, obviously, it's a little bit of managing how we can like fit here and there, because you need to, after that, you need to identify what are the roles and what are the demands of each. What is my role into my family and what are the demands for it? And what are my roles and demands as an associate coach? As an associate coach, I need to take care of the recruiting. I need to take care of the defensemen and defensive aspects such as PK with the team. I need to take care of the administration part, the FMH relationship. I'm sure a few guys have got my calls. I'm not annoying. I'm just trying to reconnect everybody. And as well, other like connective tasks. As my doctorate right now, it's to building my literature review, my ethics. So how can I fit that into what takes the most time in my days? What takes the less time in my days? It's working pretty good so far.
Quite frankly, I did exactly the same thing, although I was running that whole hockey program back then and doing my doctorate at Université Montréal. And you're right, you had to make clear-cut decisions as to what time was going to be applied to what, and what part of the season could you focus on what, or non-season, of course, right?
Exactly. And, that plays a big role as well. Like, you know that October, November are hockey months.
Yeah.
Yeah. As July is not a hockey month.
At least not in your situation.
No, exactly.
When you talk about family, who are you talking about?
Well, obviously, I'm talking about close family. My girlfriend, Chelsea, my little daughter, she's 2 months now, a little bit more than 2 months now. And also, I would include like my dad, my brothers. This is very important for me to like stay connected. I'm from Quebec City. They all live back there. Either I make the trip or they make the trip. They need to see my Lolar. We need to see each other. This is very important for me.
That's very nice. And the 2 month old, you've got to watch for your sleep time as well.
Yeah, we all know that hockey guy doesn't sleep too much. So we're good with that. We're used to it. The long nights and the early mornings, we're used to that. That's not a problem.
Yeah, it takes a special spouse to be able to manage a person in a program in a career. With the amount of intensity that you have in both of your careers, both academia at that level that you're at and in coaching at the level that you're at.
Very, very special.
Yeah, very special type of person, and it's typically a very intense person who needs his deep focus time in both areas, deep focus in your research and deep focus in your coaching. Working with Ork, he's coming in. He's had a head coaching job with the national team over in Europe. So he's had good international experience. He's had tons of hockey experience as a player and as a coach, largely assistant. He's going as a head coach. He's quite a competent young man. And you're coming in first time as an associate coach with no experience as associate, although assistant coaching and the opportunity to have been with the Canadians has got to have helped you tons. How is it coming in and both of you assuming new roles?
So the primary thing that we identified was we needed to have a great communication. If we communicate the information to each other well, we can make better informed decision. That's either with our current player, with our prospective recruits, with administration for stuff. So we made sure that we had like regular meetings. We plan times for both of us to be able to prepare for a practice, time for both of us to watch meetings together, time for to like all the little aspect. And this way, I think it helped us grow at the same time as a duo to help better our players and help better the program in the long run.
A lot of what you're talking about is planning, mapping out the season, mapping out every day, mapping out where you can do what you want to and need to do for the program, and yet being able to be flexible enough to adapt based on the situation you find yourself in.
Well, exactly. You need to have a plan at the beginning and after adapt with every single situation, which is something I feel we learn when we get to McGill, that like you need to adapt because every day is different. But if you have a plan and going into every single day with a certain plan, well, you're able to achieve a certain objective that you fix to yourself.
How do you read what he's doing as head coach and say, this fits perfectly with my strengths? Here's what I contribute in comparison to what he's contributing.
Well, there's a few different things we were talking about. I'm going to start by studies. He's a sports psychology guy. I'm an exercise physiology kind of guy, which is good because we're not thinking the same way right away. After that, he has experience as a stand coach. I've experienced as strength conditioning coach. So it's again, it's a compliment. AHL, NHL, it's different league. It's not the same league. So it's different experience. Forward defenseman, power play specialist, more of a PK specialist, I would say. So it's all like little things like this that help us complement each other and in a certain way. We often think that those are far apart from each other. But I made a presentation, where was it, in University of Montreal, I think it's 2 years ago. And a friend of mine that teach there now, Jeff Caron, which was at McGill before, now he's a professor there, came to watch the presentation and talking about like what I'm doing with the Montreal Canadiens back then. And we go for a beer and he tells me, he's like, You know what, Pat? Most of your job is more sport psychology stuff than exercise physiology stuff. And I'm like, you're probably right. That's probably what I'm mostly what I talk about during that presentation.
I
So like
don't.
one complement the others.
Absolutely. And I picked that up as well as you were talking about reading the situation that the person or the athlete finds himself in that given day and how to adapt to optimize your time with that athlete and enhance the level of motivation and yet adapt to their motivational swings. That's not physiology, that's psychology. Yep.
No.
What do you expect from this team this year?
Compete. We always say that like we're relentless, we work hard, we want to achieve big things, but what we're looking for into our players is competing every single day. Every single time we're getting onto the ice for a practice, for a game, for a morning skate, or getting into the gym is to compete, not just against each other, but for each other as well. If you get into the on the ice on a practice and you're doing a flow drill, you might not compete, be competing against an opponent, you're competing against yourself. And that's what we're looking for into with our team this year.
In terms of outcome, what are you looking for?
So if I would give you an outcome right now, it wouldn't be fair because we told our player it's going to be a process. And if I place the outcome before the process, I'm not respecting what we're telling them. So I'm not going to give you an outcome.
Good answer. I couldn't nail Dave down on that particular question either. They're saying to follow the process effectively. The wins will come if they're deserved, as long as we follow the process.
As long as we follow the process, the score is going to take care of itself.
Yeah, well, it is, and yet you're hired to be fired, especially in pro, and you've seen that in your pro
Oh, yeah.
career, and that's on the black and white, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee that that's how you've got to coach. On the other hand, as a coach, you do need to know how you can have impact with the team to get short-term wins. Okay, and the challenge that I see, especially with the process orientation the two of you have. And certainly justifiably so. And the academic orientation the both of you have is that street smart coach who knows how to get a win out of any particular game. And that's the question I challenge to you is if you want to follow the process, but you can go for the win and you know what you got to do, but it's counter to the process, what do you do?
Depends. Are we in an exhibition game or in a regular season game? Are we at the end of the season or at the beginning of the season? Always depends. Those aspects all that take into account. I think we're going to stick to our process and we're going to have some times that we might deviate to it a little bit because obviously the objective of any hockey team is at the end is to win. However, there's a certain way of winning that we're going to look for.
And it's the process, you say, it's the process. It's the process of winning. And the winning comes because you follow the process.
And you need to learn how to win as well.
Okay. And what do you mean? Yeah, please do tell me about that.
This is a big thing. Like McGill has a rich history, won in the past. We have 20 new players on the team. Our new players need to learn that what is the McGill way of winning and how you're able to win those little games because we're going to play against like only four different opponents this year during the regular season. And
Yeah.
how you can win those like one goal game is a very important part of the game.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your competition this year?
I would love to, but except videos, I didn't watch them. I saw Concordia. Can talk about Concordia.
Twice. Yeah, twice. Yeah, tight games I
You
see
play.
already. Yeah.
Well, Concordia is always fun because it's a cross-town rivalry. Those guys all play against each other. Some are friends, some are old enemies from major junior teams, some are don't even know each other, but it's just the emotion level is very high, and we need to control our emotion in the long run, and that's gonna help us learn how to win.
Excellent, which means you don't get into penalty trouble or undisciplined issues if you can maintain your focus. That's what I hear you
Ex
saying.
exactly, and like the highs are not too high and the lows are not too lows.
And didn't you have an issue of that with, not you, but the hockey team with respect to, I do believe it was the Carleton team that seemed to bring out the worst because of their rough, shall we call it rough style or rowdy style?
They do have a Carlton do have a rough style, What they look like this year is a good question because they haven't played in a while. I saw them a little bit on videos, but so far we don't have much on them because they have played like two games, so they probably have nothing on us as well.
What about the coaching staff? Is that coaching staff changed?
Not much.
Okay, so they've got the same people putting the team together. So you can probably expect the same type of approach.
It's funny because everywhere you go, there's always like you go to Concordia, you're expecting the same style of play. You go to UQTR, you know they have a small barn. You know it's going to be a physical game. It's going to be like a gritty game. And they still have some skill to play in there. So it's going to be a tight game. You go to Ottawa, you know there's going to be a lot of speed. The ice is a little bit bigger. There's more room on the ice. You go to Carleton, it's a smaller rink again. It's going to be very physical. They play the Ontario way. We call that the OUA rule.
Which is?
I'm not going to say it. You're going to have to come to the FMH weekend if you want to know the rest of that sentence.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to make it over the ocean for that one.
You call me that night. I'll let you know that night.
Okay. Your best of and worst of Miguel stories.
The best of the worst first.
Yeah. What's the best of? The good, the bad, let's go
the ugly first.
Okay. Okay. Give us the ugly first.
So the ugly first would probably be my first year at McGill, our Christmas trip. So I think we were planned to fly to Thunder Bay on the 26th, 27th, or 28th, doesn't matter. But that day, the biggest snowstorm in Montreal appeared to happen in the history. So the most snow that accumulated on the ground was that day. So everybody that got back to town either were delayed by like 2-3 hours. The practice got delayed. Some guys that got into accidents, like not bad accidents, but like their car got out of the way. So we show up to practice. We have a practice. Obviously, the plane is delayed. Then the plane is canceled. So we all go back to 4, 5, 6, play together, eat a little bite, and everybody go back home. We were taking the plane the following day, I think at 6. On the plane again, that's the day of the game. We're going to say that's the 29th for the story. The 29th in the morning, we're playing the 29th at night and the 30th at night to fly back home after. So we're in the airport. Everybody's tired because nobody went to bed the night before because it was the biggest snowstorm ever. We're in the airport. The plane is delayed again. We have a connection at Porter Airport in Toronto. We showed up to the connection. We miss our flight. We get stuck at the airport. I think guys got into 2 or 3 different planes. Some guys basically showed up for the game. The guys that were not dressing up, they showed up for the game because they didn't get there before that. We went straight from the airport to the game. Like, so the school bus, I think it was a school bus back then that picked us up, straight to the game. And the worst of all is I think we got 2 or 3 players injured during that weekend. We got hammered on the board. The team was huge and we were not ready for that. We're still talking about that trip. Oh, it was like a disaster. Oh, we missed it so bad.
Very tough.
It's just a funny story to say, but when we talk about it, we're like, cannot believe that we did this and that didn't work out like this. I remember Palms got out, I think he got out on a CVR.
You mean on a stretcher?
Yeah, he was taken out on a stretcher. Okay. He was taken off on a stretcher from the ice. We got a few guys that like got bump and bruises, couldn't play the second night. It was bad. It was a bad road trip in general.
So that's the ugly.
Yeah, that's the ugly. The best will probably be in general, Saskatoon National Championship. It's a road trip of 13 days that we made. We went to the Queen's Cup. Unfortunately, we lost the Queen's Cup 2-1 on a bad play.
Windsor.
Against Windsor. We got scored in the first minute on a trick play. The door play that they called. And you know what's funny? It's like this play was run by Kelly when he was in Laurier before. So we got tricked at our own play a few years later. So we lost 2-1 against them. But we still made the trip to National. After that, we had to bus back to Toronto. Then we flew back to Saskatoon. And we just had like a good run. It was just a great group of guys. We had fun. We studied all together in the room that we had. Laprelle was our video coach back then. Laprelle made
Chris
a great video, courtesy of Laprelle. I'm sure you guys will hear Rosie saying it. It was amazing. It was just a good time. We played good games there. I think guys can be proud of the games that we play against Carleton, which we beat. We lost, unfortunately, against Alberta, like I said earlier. But it was just an overall great experience with friends that are going to last forever. which at the end of the day, what else can you ask for?
Well, I think that's a great spot to end it. I'm a firm believer that especially the coaching that you're doing right now in this program is something that each one of these athletes will have forever in their life story. And the best of friends that they will ever have are going to be those friends that you've brought them together on, that they've worked together on, that they've competed together on, and they've worked together as a team to compete. Success or failure, it doesn't matter. They're in there together. And it's a great way to end this up with your own story about your friendship. And you started our conversation that way as well, talking about the roomies that you had your first night there at four, five, six.
When I stayed there, my recruiting trip was Evan Boston, Evan Zupon, and Pat Belzil. When I stayed the year after, it was only Pat Belzil who was still there.
Yeah, and you carried on the tradition. And
I'm still in contact with Pat Belzil.
That's a huge part of what you're doing, is, and I can see that with the core value you've got, the McGill way, along with the joy. And of course, you can hear the relentlessness every time you talk about how you're prioritizing your life and the way you take steps forward. It's just it's an absolute delight to be able to hear. That's the kind of person who's leading our hockey program. So we're very honored to have you back, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can't you just hear the wheels whirling as he speaks? PDH impresses me as a very deep thinker, a committed family man, and a laser-focused coach. However, my favorite takeaway from the podcast is that, as a McGill player, he really did keep his elbows up and had to learn to keep his stick on the ice. Inside of that were many lessons of leadership. Until the next time, here's wishing you a great start of the season and a fantastic FMH weekend. Signing off, this is Ken Tyler.